As many of you probably know, lately, that is to say over the last week or so, there has been some excitement because there was a paper which appeared by Mike Green and others, which somehow suggests that supergravity, in n equal to 8 supergravity, even in 4 dimensions, might be a finite theory. This actually is something that is hard work behind this, appears to be something that has been done at various places, but particularly UCLA, with Sri Burr and Radu Roiban, who is at Penn State, is collaborating with Sri, and they might have just put out their own detailed paper, or it is just about to come out. So this is kind of a little bit of excitement, and if possible, we might have international LQG seminar on this in December. If not, then early next semester, just to know about this finiteness result. Is Wilson ready?
Yes.
Okay. So
we are ready to start.
Okay. Okay. So today, when Jorge is away, so I'll chair the session, and we're going to have a talk by Wilson Fairbairn, and the topic is matter in quantum BF theory. Wilson.
Thank you very much. So hello, everyone. I would like to say that I'm very happy to participate as a speaker to these international loop quantum gravity seminars. I would also like to thank all the people here in PI for welcoming me here today. So originally, I was intending to speak only about fermions in three-dimensional quantum gravity in a spin-form approach. And thinking about it, then I sort of really wanted also, if the time is possible, we will see that, to also extend this work to describe also some results in four dimensions, quantum BF in four dimensions coupled to string-like sources. So we will see if we have time to do that. Otherwise, we'll just talk about the first part of this talk on fermions. Okay. So we can go to transparency number 2. So the first part of this talk it concerns some work that I have recently done concerning coupling of fermionic fields to Riemannian quantum gravity in three dimensions using spin-form technologies. So I will give a quick introduction, an introductory review on spin-form models and their different attempts to couple matter to these models. I will speak a bit about the classical theory and the geometrical framework underlying the coupling of fermions to two-dimensional GR. Then we will go into the core of the spin-form quantization process and define a discretization of the manifold and of the fields. I will then introduce the main tool used throughout this work, which is a fermionic loop expansion of the fermionic determinant appearing by integrating out the fermionic fields. I will show how to make sense of the integrals and the path integral using generating functional techniques. And the computation of these integrals will lead us to the subtle interplay between fermions and quantum geometry. So we can go to slide number 3, please. As I was saying, this is not sure that we will make it. If we have time, we will speak also about some work in progress with Alejandro Perez in Marseille concerning the solving, an attempt to solving the dynamics of the recently proposed model by Alex and John Bayer of string sources coupled to four-dimensional BF theory, here from the canonical aspect. So I'll briefly speak about classical theory, the derivation that they have of the kinematical Hilbert space, and how we can make sense of the dynamics by defining the generalized projection operator, and finally show how to remove the regularization that we would have used to define this projection operator by showing that the amplitudes are topological invariant. So we can now go to slide number 4. So this first part of this talk. So this is work concerns fermion in 3D spin-form quantum gravity. So we can directly go to slide number 5. So this is an introductory review. So basically, spin-form models, well, they're models which lie at the crossroad of many paths, but essentially we can see them either coming from a canonical theory where they can be understood, for instance, a new quantum gravity as a space-time history interpolating between boundary spin network states, namely as an implementation of the physical scalar product of new quantum gravity, as was first found by Carlo and Michael Reisenberger, and recently reformulated by Alejandro Perez. However, spin four models can live completely independently from new quantum gravity as a very general framework which provides a computational tool to calculate the path integrals of a large class of BF-like field theories. By this I mean theories expressible as a free BF term with a given polynomial interaction. And this point of view is due to the seminal work by John Baez and by some work by Laurent Fedel and Kirill Krasnov. So the crucial issue in these approaches are, of course, the coupling of matter to these theories. Basically there are two main pictures which seem to come out of all the literature. And basically there are these two main ideas are the fact that somehow matter could be already there. I mean, I think that this is an idea that most of us would like to see implemented one day, namely that the matter degrees of freedom are somehow encoded in the quantum geometry of space-time. So this approach has been, for instance, developed by Lewis Crane, by Mikovich. Let me also quote a work by Petra Levine and Robert Oakle, where they derive the supersymmetric spin four model, where somehow the fermions are hidden in the gauge field theory, so this provides sort of unification perspective too. So just a parenthesis here, talking about matter already contained in these models, I am not quoting here the recent work by Lee, Fotini, and Sundance, and also I'm not quoting all the work which has been done from the canonical aspect concerning the couplings to matter. I apologize to all the authors, but I'm trying to condense things and make a talk here only on spin form, so this is why I'm concentrating only on these approaches. So other perspectives have been developed, namely matter has been also added by coupling to the gravitational field. So the first item that I described here, the coupling of point particles with three-dimensional quantum gravity, could somehow maybe be classified in the first perspective, namely we could see these point particles simply as conical defects of the space-time manifold, so they could somehow appear only as a given property of space-time at a given point. So they could be seen as already there, but in practice they can appear by coupling to the action. So this is why I have classified them in the matter added by coupling. So this work is due to Laurent Fredel, David Duap, Karine Nui, and Alejandro Perez did some the canonical counterpart of this work and obtained spin-form amplitudes. And more recently, let me quote the work by Laurent Fredel, Kowalski-Glickman, and Artem Starodubtsev, coupling Wilson lines to the Dusseter gauge theory formulation of gravity. So just to pursue a bit on this perspective, there has recently been discovered a quite amazing duality between the Feynman diagrams of field theories and spin-form models. So this is work due to John Barrett in three dimensions. Fredel and Levine have shown that the G goes to zero limit of a given spin four model coupled to point particles yield Feynman diagrams. And this is the work by Aristide Baratin and Laurent Fredel, which study this duality in three and four dimensions. So there have also been some attempts to couple string-like and brain-like sources in four dimensions. So this is the work by John Best and Alejandro Perez that I was mentioning previously. And also some work to appear that I will discuss if I have time. And let me conclude by discussing the Jungmuir's fields coupling to the Barrett-Crane model of four-dimensional quantum gravity by Danilo Ritti, Hendrik Pfeiffer, and Mikovic. So we can switch to slide number 6. So on this slide, I just described the heuristics idea behind what I'm going to present here. So here in this talk, I'm going to concentrate on Dirac fermionic fields coupled to three-dimensional Riemannian gravity. In the spin-form approach, the Riemannian assumption is simply to have a compact symmetry group, which makes life easier. So the goal is to compute the partition function. So very heuristically, the strategy is to integrate out the fermions, which will lead, as we will see, to a given functional determinant that we will then expand. This expansion has to be precisely defined. This will be the goal of this talk. It is not a Feynman diagram expansion. Moreover, it's more kind of inverse mass expansion. We will see this in detail. But basically, this will give us a sum over fermionic loops. And so inserting this in the path integral, we will derive a path integral for the model as a finite sum over expectation values of observables defined by these fermionic loops. And the goal of this talk is to make a precise sense of all the heuristic picture described in this transparency. So we can go to the next slide. So brief word on the classical theory. So here, the geometrical framework, as we are considering the coupling of fermions to gravity, is the Einstein-Cartan framework, Einstein-Cartan structures, which means that we have a differential three-dimensional manifold that are space-time, and we define on it an orthonormal bundle of frames, which is the principal bundle with structure group, the isometric group of the purely Euclidean metric here, so namely SL3. And we define the connection on this bundle, which is called the metric connection or gravitational connection. And moreover, we suppose that there exists a spin structure on this manifold. So we suppose that we can define a principal bundle with structure group, the spin group associated to the same metric. So this is spin 3 or SU2. And assume that there is a 2-to-1 bundle homomorphism mapping the two. So the action, the dynamics are contained in the following action, which breaks into two terms. First, the gravitational part, and then the fermionic part. So the gravitational part is the well-known action for three-dimensional gravity, which is a BF theory. So kappa is related to the Newton constant. E is the gravitational field, namely the soldering form, supposed to be an isomorphism of vector spaces between the tangent space over a given point P of the manifold and the vector representation space R3. And R is the curvature of the metric connection omega. And the brackets here denote the Killing form on the Lie algebra of SO3. The Dirac part is governed by the action given by equation number 6. So basically, you see a kinetic part in this action, which contains covariant derivatives with respect to the spin connection, which is a connection defined on the spin bundle. So this is denoted by the letter nabla here. So you can clearly see this kinetic term containing the derivatives and a mass term for the action, which is proportional to the space-time volume. So finally, to finish with the notation, the sigma symbols here are a given map from the Clifford algebra associated to the purely Euclidean metric, which takes value in the space of 2x2 complex matrices. So this is a representation of this Clifford algebra of interest here. And the spinner fields are sections of the spinner bundle, namely functions which take value in the fundamental representation of the spin group. So we can go to slide number 8.
Just a second. On this slide number 7, What is the difference between omega and omega hat? You have connection omega in the gravitational part, and you have connection omega hat, or something omega hat, in the Dirac part.
Right, so omega is a connection on the orthonormal frame bundle, so it's a connection which takes value in the Lie algebra of SO3, which is related to the spin connection, which takes value, which is a connection on the spin bundle, so it's a connection which takes value in the spin group, and the two connections are obviously related, as there is a Lie algebra isomorphism mapping SO3 onto SU2, so you can explicitly write the spin connection omega as simple function of the metric connection, or in terms of the sigma matrices. Does this answer your question?
Yes. Thank you. I was asking mainly for clarification for students. But I do have another question, which is, a couple of times you referred to omega as being a metric connection, as though there was a background metric. You probably did not mean that, did you? As far as I can understand, the gravitational action is just a functional of a coframe E and a general connection omega on the particular bundle that you're considering, line bundle, the frame bundle that you're considering. And so there is no a priori metric. It's just a, omega is also a connection which is completely independent of the frame. Is that correct?
Yes. Amy, yes, you're totally right to stress that point. The reason why this metric, this connection is called metric is simply that it knows about the reduction that you do from going to the principal bundle with structure from GL3. When you reduce that to the bundle of orthonormal frames, SL3, this connection knows about this reduction. I mean, there is a metricity condition on this connection which states that the covariant derivative with respect to this connection of the metric is zero. I mean, lengths and angles are conserved in parallel transport with this connection. And so this connection knows about this reduction. So it, all it means, I mean, practically, the I'm calling it metric. I know that this is maybe not the correct name. Maybe we don't like this name. But it's just that it takes value in SO3, which is the metric group of the flat metric.
Yeah. I think in our community, we don't call it a metric connection. It's just the SO3 or SU2 connection. So in your case, it's SO3 connection. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment, Abai. So the next slide, we basically enter the spinform quantization procedure here. So, I mean, as I was saying in the introductory slides, our goal here as a first step, of course, to define an interesting model is to compute the path integral. Of course, then we would need to go to the propagators. The main problem with working with path integrals obviously is the fact that we don't control really the analytical existence of the functional integrals. So one way of going through this, one way of solving this issue is to put a cutoff on the physical degrees of freedom of the theory by choosing a triangulation of the space-time manifold, which means that we simply subdivide it into a finite union of the three simplices, that is tetrahedra. So in the first line here, delta 3 refers to a three simplex, namely a tetrahedron. Delta 2 will be a two simplex, so this is a triangle, and delta 1 will be a segment of the triangulation, namely a line. So as it is customary in spinform models, this obviously comes from the relationship to the canonical framework. We usually work with the dual two skeleton of this triangulation, which means that we consider the set of vertices, edges, and faces, which are constructed as follows. Into the center of each tetrahedron, you can place a vertex, link different vertices by edges, going through the triangles of this tetrahedra, which are called the edges, E, note E, then define a face as a closed sequence of edges, and this defines what we call the dual two skeleton of the triangulation. So this is the structure with which we will work. And so we define the discretization of the field of the theory as follows. So the triad, namely the gravitational field, is discretized by assigning a vector in inertial space in R3 to each one of the length vectors defining the segments of the triangulation. And because these segments are one-to-one correspondence with the faces, this vector here in R3 contains a little index f. So the spin connection is discretized by defining its parallel transport along the edges of the dual triangulation. So we assign to each edge a spin space rotation. The gravitational connection is discretized by parallel transporting the spin connection in the adjoint representation of the spin group. So we assign a space-time rotation also to these edges. The curvature being defined as the obstruction to the closing of the horizontal lift of an infinitesimal loop can be approximated by computing the curvature, the holonomy, around the edges, around the boundary edges of a given face. And now the fermions, which are the objects of interest here, because we want the components of these fermions to obey a Fermi-Dirac statistics, we require that these components live in a given Grassmann algebra, which is constructed as the exterior algebra over a given complex vector space that I define here, which satisfies the correct properties. And concerning the notations, ij, vj define the representation and the associated representation space.
associated to the SPIN-J unitary irreducible representations of SU2. So we can go to slide number 9. So here in this slide, I provide a discretization of the action of the coupled system. So, in equation 8, we have got the discretized gravitational part, where we basically sum over all the faces of the spin foam and trace the product E times lambda. So E here is regarded as an element of the Lie algebra. And the Dirac part of the action is discretized in equation 9. So clearly you recover the presence of this kinetic term that we had already in the continuum framework, which is provided where the covariant derivatives are provided by the discretized spin connections. And there are importantly here two polynomial functions of the gravitational field of the simplicial triad here, which appear in this action of equation number 9. Namely, this function that I have noted AI and V, which basically are discretized area and volume forms. So how are they constructed? Well, just look at equation number 10, the first line. So the little index in AI UV, the UV means that we are considering the edge linking the vertices U and V. And so this part here, so to understand its meaning, just imagine that we fix a given dual edge. So this means that we are looking at this dual edge, which is dual, topologically dual to a triangle of the triangulation. And so what we do is we fix a given pair of vectors here, which generate this triangle. And using the gravitational field, we map them in R3, obtain a given pair of vectors, and we then simply compute the cross product of these two vectors and obtain in internal space an area one form, in the sense that the norm of this vector would give us the physical area of the triangle that we are considering. So to make sense and not have any ambiguities here, we sum over all possible pairs, and we do roughly the same thing for the volume. Namely, we fix a given vertex, that is a given tetrahedron, and just fix a given triple of vectors in coordinate space, length vectors in the tangent space of the manifold, map them into R3, we get another triple of vectors, and we just simply compute their determinant, and this gives us the physical volume of the tetrahedron dual to the vertex B. So we can now move on to slide number 10. So the interesting part is that you have probably realized that the fermionic action is bilinear in psi and psi bar. So this is crucial when going to the integration theory. So this means that we can compactly re-express all the fermionic part of the action as a term of the form psi bar W psi, where this W can be regarded as a matrix which acts on the space of simplicial spinners. And so the crucial point regarding integration theory that we develop in the following, in the sequel, is that this element is an element, is a polynomial of second degree in the sense of exterior multiplication, which belongs to the second exterior power of our Grassmann algebra. So now that we have discretized all the theory, we can give a precise sense to the path integral defined on a fixed triangulation by defining properly the integration over the simplicial triad, where here we simply use the Riemann-Lebesgue measure on R3, so this is well defined. We can define the integral over discretized connection simply by using the Haar integral over SU2, and then to integrate over the fermions, the symbol here, deep psi bar deep psi, denotes the Bayesian integral acting on the Grassmann valued fields here, which is simply a derivation. And so the idea is to exploit the fact that this fermionic action has this structure of second order polynomial to integrate over the Grassmann invariables, and this gives you, if you compute it, and exactly the determinant of this matrix W, which once we have established this procedure, we can regard the path integral of the whole model simply as the usual path integral for gravity, but with insertion of an observable, which is this determinant coming from the fermionic action. So, of course, now, if we want to go further, we have to develop a way to calculate this fermionic determinant. So this is what we do in the following slide. So here, to understand very roughly the derivation, I'm making all sorts of simplification assumptions. I mean, the real calculation requires a little more structure and a little more work, but I'm trying to make something as clear as possible. So the idea roughly is the following. So it's very simple. You simply realize that this W matrix, recall that it comes from the fermionic action, and in this fermionic action we had the kinetic part and a volume term. So the idea is simply to split the action into these two contributions. Simply then you rescale the field such that you get a 1 over m in front of the kinetic part. And then the idea is to expand the determinant in 1 over masses. So what does this mean? Well, this means that we actually compute the determinant, which is defined as the Bayesian integral of the exponential of this fermionic action, which we have written as psi w psi, where the parentheses here mean a given Hermitian Villeneuve form. And so then we split the W into a volume part, and the kinetic part, then we simply write a power series expansion. And so what does this create? Well, if you look at the second line of equation 14, the kinetic part here, we're going to generate products, you see, which comes from the exponent k. We're going to create products of psi d psi. So these products, once we're going to integrate over the fermionic fields, are going to be enchained, and we're going to create closed sequences of products of this kinetic term d. Now recall that this kinetic term d was defined as a function of these group elements u, which were SU2 group elements. So creating these closed chains, we're going to create products of these u group elements, and basically we're going to create Wilson lines of fermions. And so in fact, this is not all. I mean, then the only terms which survive in this Bayesian integral here, when you go through the calculation, it's in fact a very strict constraint, and it tells you the following. It tells you that the only terms that are going to survive are such that on a given vertex of the dual triangulation, you either have a squared volume amplitude which lives, either a given point of the dual triangulation is exactly saturated by a given volume contribution, and this point is such that it is at the same time a starting point and an end point for a fermionic Wilson line. And this fermionic Wilson line, coming from the structure of the action, every time that a fermion is traveling through a triangle, it will come attached with an area one form, but all this will be summarized in the following transparency. So the lesson here is that when you go through the computation, you realize that this determinant can be written as a sum, a finite sum over contributions. The finite in here is due to the fact that we are using a fixed triangulation here. And so accordingly, we can start to make sense of the heuristics that I was describing in the introductory slide. And if we can write the partition function as a sum over expectation values of given observables, and these observables are the contributions coming from these Bayesian integrals.
This is Kirill with a question. Why do you treat the two terms? They're both quadratic in the fermion, so why do you treat them differently? Imagine mass is zero, for example. What would you do in that case?
That's a very good question. Thank you. Sorry, I was speaking without turning on the microphone. Of course, the massless term will have to be treated using another procedure here. I mean, roughly the idea is roughly the following. The volume part here, this volume matrix, is diagonal in spinner space. Okay, recall it. The action was of the form psi bar v psi. So it's diagonal. And so I mean very roughly the idea is then to expand the determinant around this one, this diagonal part. So I mean this is why we treat them differently, roughly speaking. Of course, I mean the massive case obviously can't be treated exactly in the same way, and I'm currently working on a way to treat the massive case. Okay. Right, so we can go to transparency number 12. Well, we've got a strange noise here, but anyhow, okay. So of course, if we want to go further in the computation here, of this determinant here. So the idea, as I was describing in the previous transparency, is basically that each one of these contributions in this sum, in this expansion of this determinant, are supported by a given fermionic loop, which is sort of a Wilson line in the one-half representation, which is attached to certain decorations, and by that I mean certain polynomial functions of the discretized gravitational field. And so, in fact, there are many contributions which comes out of the computation, but roughly we can just work with one given contribution and treat it as generic. All the details can be found in the article. So this generic contribution is in fact enough to understand the structures and techniques involved. So what have we done? We have written this partition function, inserted this fermionic determinant, expanded it in a sum of the contributions, and then we have said that this path integral could be seen as the sum of the expectation values of these particular contributions, which are now explicitly given by the following equation, which is equation number 16, where on each vertex which is not traversed by a fermion line, you get a square volume. On each vertex which is traversed by a fermionic line, you get a volume contribution. And each triangle traversed by a fermion creates the insertion of this area discretized function A of I, whose index gets contracted with the one of the Pauli matrices appearing in the trace over the fermionic loop, which is in fact a Wilson line with sigma matrices insertions. So now the question is, of course, how to compute the integrals over the triad and over the discretized connection in the path integral. So we have inserted this observable in the path integral, and now to make sense of it, of course, we have to be able to integrate over the triad and over the discretized connections. So to this aim, it is pretty straightforward to integrate over the group elements, but over the triad, it is an issue which is non-trivial, and for that, we just follow the generating functional techniques which were developed by Laurent Friedel and Kirill Krasnov.
Could we just stop at transparency 12 just for a second?
Yes.
As you said, you just split the determinant into sum, and you're just looking at each term in the sum. But can you tell us where the Wilson line came up? Because, we had fermions, and we had, and the fermions were all over the place, right? At each vertex, there was amplitude for the fermion. So how did the Wilson line arise in this whole summation?
Okay, so I'm going to try and be a bit more explicit. Maybe we can come back on the previous transparency.
Number 11? Is it 11?
Yeah, yes, excuse me, I did not precise. Yes, number 11. Yes, so the way the fermionic lines appear is in fact really due to this Bayesian integral. What you say is completely correct. I mean, to start with, the fermion lives on every vertex here. But when you make this Taylor series expansion here, you get products of kinetic terms which are associated to the edges of this triangulation. And so when you make this Paris expansion, what you create is products of kinetic terms which are, localized around a given edge. I mean, then, you have to sum over all the possible edges supporting the fermionic loops. This is what you get at the end. But the fermionic lines really come from, you see this in equation 14, the exponent here of the form psi d psi create products of kinetic terms which are associated to a given path on the dual triangulation. And when you integrate over the fermionic fields, basically what this says is that the group elements get attached. I mean, they get multiplied. And finally, the whole thing closes, and you create a fermionic line. And then, on all the other vertices which are not traversed, but this is a given configuration. I mean, we've got many, many terms in this sum. But for a given configuration, you get this closing of these group elements, this tracing, which creates a Wilson line. And everywhere else, you get squared volumes. And then you simply sum over all the edges supporting these given fermionic loops. Does that clear the picture a little bit?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so maybe we can come back to slide number 12, 11. Right, okay, because now we're gonna try and make sense of equation 15. Now this is basically the goal of the whole thing. So try and recall of this equation here. What have we got? We have got the calculation of the expectation value of a given contribution coming out in this sum. So what have we have to know how to integrate? We have to integrate over the triads, which are associated to each face of the dual complex, and on group elements, which are assigned to each edge of the dual complex. So these integrals have now to be performed to be able to obtain a number, which we will then sum up to get the complete partition function. So we can now come back to transparency 12. We have now defined this observable, and so now we have to be able to compute the integrals over the triads and over the group elements of this given object here. Yes.
Kirill again.
We can't hear anything.
Question to understand this volume squared everywhere and then Wilson lines everywhere else. Will there be terms when volume, so to get a non-trivial Bayesian integral, you need ferment twice in the same vertex, right? Will there be any cross terms by volume and then this piece of the kinetic term?
I understand that
if you separately expand the volume term, you will get this volume squared everywhere.
Exactly.
If you separately expand the kinetic part,
yes,
you will get Wilson loops,
yes,
everywhere.
Yes.
Are there any cross terms?
In the actual integration.
Yes,
exactly. Yes,
exactly. What do they mean?
I mean, the cross terms are, in fact, the terms which are telling you that for a given term in the sum, so you've got your dual complex, you've got this line, and everywhere around the line, you get the squared volumes. You see? And on the line, you get these simple volumes. And in fact, these cross terms are the ones creating the fact. If you were just looking at the kinetic term as you were stressing, you would only obtain this Wilson line, as you were saying, with the area and blah, blah, blah. And now the cross terms tell you that you have non-vanishing terms. Everywhere outside the loop, you have to have these squared volumes.
I don't understand why the cross terms guarantee that.
I mean, by cross terms, do you mean the fact that I also expand the volume part?
Yes.
Yes, exactly. Well, this is, I mean, we'd have to look this, I mean, to extend this in detail to go through the calculations, but.
Okay. Yeah, we can discuss it later.
Okay. But this is a very important question. Thank you, Kirill. So, so we can now try and compute these integrals and go to transparency number 13. So, recall the goal is to compute all these integrals of these given expectations, these given observables. So, as I was saying, the non-trivial fact is to integrate over the simplicial triads. I mean, this is the integration which is going to encode the effects of non-trivial curvature in this theory, and this is a non-trivial task. So, I mean, the idea underlying this whole thing is very simple. Is given by equation 17, when you get a given term in your path integral which is of the form E of F, well, you can simply rewrite this as the derivative with respect to a given current of the exponential of the trace of E times J, where J is a discretized true form, and evaluate the whole thing at J equals 0. So this is roughly the idea. So now, generalizing this idea, you say that any function that will appear in this path integral, which is monomial, the polynomial of a given degree, n, well, we're going to treat that as a differential operator of same degree, which is going to act on a given generating functional and evaluate the whole thing at j equals 0. So this is the idea to make sense of polynomial functions of the triad appearing in this path integral. And so, of course, because we are regarding this theory where you get this polynomial lines here going around, we have to choose the generating functional such that operation of derivation with respect to these currents will produce the correct observables that we are looking for. So we define the generating functional by equation 19 by defining it with the insertion of a given fermionic line, and the source such here is chosen such that in the continuum limit you recover a continuum source action. You see, this is the last equation of the form E wedge R plus E wedge J, such that if I derive already at the continuum level with respect to J, I will create polynomials of the triad. So this is the idea that we will follow. So now, of course, the idea is to compute this generating functional, because once we know how to compute it, we'll be able to act with it with differential operators and obtain a number which will be the expectation value that we are looking for, which appear in this fermionic loop expansion. So the roughly we can go through, so the idea is to integrate, of course, over the triad and over the connections. So at first, we integrate over the triads. We don't need to get into any details here. All we need to know is that the integral of the triad is going to create a delta function on the group. And because each integral of the triad was assigned to the faces of the spin foam, well, we're going to get a delta function on each face, which we then expand into characters. And the only thing we need to remember here to understand the sequel is that this procedure basically assigns a given unitary irreducible representation of the spin group to each of the faces of the spin form. Just a remark here, I'm simplifying drastically what happens. Usually to use these techniques, one has to furthermore refine the dual triangulation and go to so-called wedges, which were introduced by Michael Reisenberger. But here, for the sake of clarity, I'm just forgetting these issues. So all we need to remember now is when we want to calculate this generating functional, we have integrated over the syncytial triad, and that this integration has created an assignment of a spin J to each face of the spin form. So we can now move on, and once we have established this, we now want to integrate over the group elements. Okay? We have integrated over the triad, assigned a representation to each face, and now we want to integrate over the group elements. So this
we are on slide 14 now.
15?
What slide are we now on?
Yes, excuse me. Slide number 15, I'm sorry. We have moved to slide number 15. So this is when we're going to integrate over this discretized connection. This is where the effects of non-trivial torsion I am going to come out of the game. We are really going to see the effects of fermionic matter on the quantum torsion here. This is very nice. So there are two cases. We are computing this generating functional, so away from the fermionic loop, the spin form does not know anything about the fermions, and on each dual edge of the triangulation, we have three faces which meet. So this comes from the fact that each edge, recall, is dual to a triangle, and each triangle is built out of three segments. So in the dual picture, each edge is shared by three faces. Now, the integration, I'm looking at the left-hand side picture here. We are far away from the fermionic loop. So now, because we have integrated over the syncytial triad and assigned a spin to each face carries a representation, and because each group element that we are integrating over are assigned to a given edge, well, we have to know how to integrate over the group the tensor product of three representation matrices. So this is standard from quantum or rigid gravity. So this creates a given intertwining operator and is a joint, which is a three-valent intertwining, which is simply the whose evaluation gives the 3J symbol. So this is what happens away from the loop. This is nothing new. What is interesting is that if we have got now a given edge on which a given fermionic line is traveling, well, in this case, we're going to have some extra information. And the information is that on top of the three geometrical faces meeting on this edge, we now have got a loop, but we call that this loop is closed, so we can regard this as somehow an extra face, some half representation, which also gets attached to the same edge. So now, instead of integrating the group element assigned to the edge, instead of integrating here the tensor product of three representation, well, we integrate the tensor product of four, where the fourth is simply given by the fundamental that has noted J0, and to make contact with the previous slide, this is simply the spin three group element U. So, I mean, what is going on here? So if you go to slide number 16, how come we've got now a new representation assigned to these edges where the fermionic line is where the fermion is traveling? Well, in fact, this is the effect of quantum mechanical torsion. So I've tried to make a little picture to make this idea clearer, because it does describe the subtle interplay between fermions and quantum space-time here. So on the top picture, I have described what is happening away from a fermionic line. And on the bottom picture, I have described what is going on when a fermion is traversing a given triangle. So this is this red line, which describes a piece of the fermionic line. So on the left-hand side, we've got triangles which are on the triangles of the triangulation. Namely, they live in the tangent space or over a given point P of the manifold. And so, and on the right, what have we got? So please concentrate on the first line here of pictures. So what is going on? So in the spin form approach, what we do is that we take these triangles of the triangulation and map them in inertial space in R3. So we get a vector in internal space. And then we can consider this system as a physical system which is determined by the edge lengths of the triangles and apply to it a given quantization process, a geometrical quantization process, and one obtains a given so-called quantum triangle, as was written by John Baez and John Barrett, where basically you say that you can quantize the system, obtain a quantum triangle, where the edge, the quantum edge lengths of these triangles are encoded in the representation that are associated to these lines, and the quantum state is simply given by an intertwiner between the tensor product of these three representations and the complex. So this gives you a number, and you can see this as a quantum state of this triangle. And now, in the case where a Wilson line is going through the triangle here, what's going on is that if we map this triangle in internal space now, the triangle that we are going to obtain is not going to close. So this is classically the effect of non-trivial torsion. If you take this triangle, map it in R3, well, the three length vectors will not close into a closed triangle. And the gap which will appear here is due to the torsion. So heuristically, we could imagine that the quantum state assigned to this fermionic quantum triangle would be described by an intertwiner between the three representations assigned to the geometrical coloring, plus a fourth one, which would be in a fundamental, and which would take into account the effects of torsion. Somehow we are observing the dislocation of quantum space-time here due to the torsion. So we can now move on to slide 17, and I will definitely not have time to speak about the second part here. So we have seen what we have done. We have written the path integral, expanded it in a finite sum. Each term in the sum was an expectation value of an observable. We have tried to make sense of it by defining a generating functional and acting on it with given differential operators. So we are still in the calculation of this generating functional here. So we have been through all the integrals, except there is something that we have not written, we have not remarked here, is that if you recall of the generating functional as we have defined it, each group element defining the Wilson line was in fact attached to a given sigma matrix. And so to take this into account into the spin form framework, well, we can just rethink the Pauli matrices as intertwiners between the joint representation and the fundamental tensored with its dual. We are simply restating the fact here that the Pauli matrix recall are maps from R3 to the space of 2x2 complex matrices. So this is basically what we are saying here. So putting everything together, we have integrated over the simple short triad. This has assigned spins to each of the faces of the spin forms. And we have then integrated over the group elements. And this has created intertwiners. And putting everything together, you obtain this given function of the source J here, which is given by equation 21. So a word on the meaning of the symbols used here. So each symbol, and for instance, the second line of equation 21, are spin networks in the sense that they are graphs which encode representation theory data here. So these are not the tetrahedron of the triangulation. These are combinatorial objects. Each vertex of these graphs correspond to a given intertwiner. So you see that they have three legs. This is what we have found, except for the fermionic case. And then each line here drawn, each line in this graph is colored by a spin J. And the fact that there is this circle here with a J inside means that this line colored by a spin represents a representation matrix, which is evaluated in a corresponding representation. And this representation matrix is evaluated on the group element exponential of J. So basically, this is the picture that we obtain. On the left-hand side, you have got this modified 6J symbol that we could call a 7J, where the bold line represents the one-half fermionic line. So here you see there are two vertices where the intertwiners have four legs. This is what we've been describing in the previous slide. And you see that on this bold line is attached a new vertex. So in this terminology that we are describing here, each vertex is an intertwining operator. And so this vertex here is, in fact, the Pauli matrix that I have rethought as an intertwiner on top of equation 21. So there's a free index coming out here. So this is the result of the calculation of the generating functional. This is the function of J. Evaluated at J0, this would give you a number, which would be the expectation value of a one-half Wilson line with sigma matrices insertions coupled to three-dimensional gravity. So we can now move to slide number 18.
Let's talk to you just for a second. Okay, so this is indeed the partition function associated with J, gamma, and tau. But ultimately, we are interested in the partition function, which just depends on J and tau, right? So gamma was introduced in between in order to do this this technique of Friedel and Krasnow. But what do I do with this gamma ultimately? I mean, what I'm not interested in gamma, so what am I going to do? I'm going to sum over gamma. What am I going to do with the loops?
Yes, this is a very interesting point. Yeah, definitely. Well, we're going to sum over each of these loops in the final picture to, as you stressed, have a partition function which ultimately will only depend on the triangulation. So this, what we are doing here is for a particular contribution in this fermionic expansion, which is associated to a given loop. And so at the end, of course, we have to sum over each of these contributions and then sum over each number obtained, and we will obtain a partition function which will only depend on the triangulation. Okay, thank you. So this is just a picture here, a graphical picture to explain how the, slide number 18. So this is just a graphical picture, just to understand. You recall in the generating functional, we had sort of called what we could call 7J symbols, and this is just to show how they come out. So there is a very extremely efficient computational techniques doing this, which are mainly graphical. And so basically, this is just to explain how it comes out. Each circle here corresponds to a dual vertex. Each line is a dual face. And the dark rectangles here denote group integration. So you can see that each intertwiner on the right-hand side, you see the intertwiners of the vertices of the graph explicitly come from the hard integrals, which are respectively denoted here by all the square rectangles.
Question. indicate how those Pauli matrices are distributed?
Distributed?
Where are they?
Okay, yes, thank you. This is a very important point. Just for the clarity of the picture here, I have dropped them out. If we wanted to insert the Pauli matrices on these representation theory diagrams, you would have the line coming out, basically, for instance, a line coming out colored by the joint representation in each of the corners of this fermionic loop represented in a bold line. So when we are going to integrate, we're going to have only one fermionic line, line in the adjoint representation coming out attached to these bold lines in each one of these four diagrams. Well, for the moment, they are not connected. They're just free, and they're all over the place, and they are going to connect through the action of this area operator that we were talking about. Okay. So we can go to slide 19. Okay, so recall what we have done. We have written the partition function of the sum of expectation values of observables, and each expectation value we can now make sense of by acting with, so to say, differential operators on this given generating functional that we have just calculated and evaluating the results at j equals 0. So the last thing we need to understand is how do the differential operators act on the generating functional. So, I mean, basically all we need to know is the fact that these differential operators are going to act on the lines of the spin networks, because the lines are the guides containing the exponential of j's in the generating functional that we have defined on the previous slide. And so what we need to know is that when we derive with a given source count on the matrix representation evaluated on the element exponential of j, as can be seen in equation 23, and evaluated at j equals 0, well, what we obtain is, in fact, a given element of a chosen basis of the Lie algebra, more precisely the dual here, which is evaluated in the representation of the Lie algebra. So here's the star underneath the pi, simply means that this is the Lie algebra representation. And so it's important to stress that this Lie algebra representation also defines an intertwiner between the adjoint and the J representation, tensored with a dual. So if we go to slide number 20, we can see graphically the action that we need to understand. We need to understand how the derivative operators act on the spin networks. So as I was saying, they're going to act on the lines. So this line here represents this representation matrix evaluated on the exponential of the group element. So we have said that what it gave you was the representation of the Lie algebra evaluated on a given element of a basis of the Lie algebra. And so this is what we have on the right-hand side of equation 24. Well, what we have done, we have created a new vertex, so this is the intertwiner that I'm talking about, which is colored by the adjoint spin 1 representation. It carries an index I here. So this is basically the simple action that this derivation operators have on the lines of the spin network. So this is called the grasping operation, which is familiar to computation, for instance, of the area spectrum in quantum gravity. So the last thing we need to know is now how to make sense of these volume and area functions in the path integral. But we have said, this is equation 25 and 26, recall that these volume and area functions were defined at the beginning of this talk. So we simply follow the procedure and transform each one of the triads here into a differential operator. So we have simply taken the function we had defined previously and just followed this procedure. So now, consider this volume here. So look how it works. You've got a triple of derivatives, which is associated to a given triple of faces. So if you come back to slide number 19, 18, 17, okay. If you come back to slide 17, we're going to be able to see, just to explain how the volume works. So consider equation 21 and the spin network on the second line at the right. So this is the source 6J symbol. So this volume, recall, had a given triple of derivative operators with respect to G. So just fix one of these triples. You get one of these triples. Each one is going to act on the respective corresponding line on the spin network. So for instance, we could act with this triple on J1, J2,
and I can't read J5 probably. And when we are going to act, each one of these differential operators, as we have seen, is going to create a vertex with an open line coming out in a representation spin 1, which is a priori open. Okay, so this is the action of this triple graph spin. So coming back to the slide where we were, namely slide number 20, you see that this triple grasping operation creates three lines into a joint representation, and these three lines just then get contracted, I am in equation 25, through the epsilon ijk. So we are here regarding epsilon as another intertwining operator, which means that these three lines that we have created just close onto a given vertex, which is colored by this epsilon intertwining. And so at the end, we can go to slide number 21 and obtain the given number that we were looking for, the expectation value of a given observable associated to one given fermionic line. Then we have to effectuate the sum, as Abai was saying. And so this is the result, which is given graphically. So just basically to terminate this session here, we see that what we have done is between the square brackets, you've got the amplitudes along the fermion line. So basically, we have acted on the so second line of equation 27. We have acted with the area operator, so to say, which was attached to the fermionic line. Recall your question, Kirill. You were saying that this line, which was attached to the 1/2 line, was open, and it then closes with the epsilon coming in from the definition of this area function. And we have then acted with the volume. And then at below, we have the action of the squared volume on all the vertices where no fermion is present. The symbols in the sums where I have written grasp mean that we are summing over all triples and pairs of graspings. And the symbols k's are simply normalization factors. So it's important to stress here in this result that we've got a given a certain quantization ambiguity. For instance, if you look at the last line of this equation, you see that one of the lines could be grasped twice. And there is an ambiguity here because you have to decide whether the first action grasps on top or below the spin network, and accordingly the number that you will obtain will not be the same. So in the paper, I prescribe a procedure to sort of symmetrize these ambiguities, but of course this would have to be studied in more details. So I think that we are 4 minutes late, and I will not have a chance to talk about the second project I was intending to. So I suppose that I'll just stop here, and thank you for your attention.
Before we take general questions and so on, maybe it would be good to sort of summarize where are we, in the sense that you had this path integral to calculate, you fixed a particular triangulation. Now that we have got a theory, which is not a topological theory, because we've got 2 degrees of freedom coming from fermions, everything still depends on this triangulation. And so what do we do with this triangulation? And finally, I mean, are we taking continuum limit? Are we summing over triangulation? What is the general idea?
Thank you, Abai. This is a very interesting point. So as you stressed, the theory we are considering here is obviously not a topological theory. We've got local degrees of freedom. So obviously, I mean, this result is valid only on the fixed triangulation. So maybe to help the discussion, we could go to slide number 30, where I give a conclusion of this work on these fermions here. 30.
Okay, maybe you can just read it so that people can follow you.
Okay, right, exactly. So this is basically just a summary of what we have discussed in this talk here. So we have constructed a given spin 4 model of massive fermionic fields coupled to 3D Riemannian quantum gravity. We have computed the path integral of the coupled system. The approach has been based on a discretization of the manifold. So we have first integrated out the fermions. obtained the path integral for quantum gravity with insertion of the observable. We have expanded this determinant in fermionic loops. Each term in this sum was the expectation value of an observable. We have shown a way to compute these different contributions, order by order, and the idea is to sum up all the terms at the end to get a number. So as you were stressing out, of course there is a very crucial open issue here, which is the presence of local degrees of freedom. So I mean, this implies in particular a heavy dependence on the triangulation, which is sort of the difficulties that the spin foam approach coming from this covariant perspective have once you start working with local degrees of freedom. So namely, this issue is shared, for instance, anytime you pump in local degrees of freedom, so for example in the Barrett train model. So the way that people have been trying to get rid of this dependence on the triangulation is to use group field theory techniques, which is a very beautiful approach where you basically write a field theory on a group manifold and you construct it such that the frame and amplitudes of this theory defined on a given graph gives you exactly the spin foam amplitude that you would have calculated using this graph as a dual triangulation. And so because you then get a sum over all the Feynman diagrams, somehow this procedure gets rid of the dependence on the triangulation. So to go around this issue, I mean, I think that one way of doing this is probably to follow these group field theory prescriptions. And here I quote some very interesting work which has been done concerning this approach by Kirill Krasnov, by Laurent Fredel, Daniele Ricci, Jimmy Ryan, and recently Daniele and Jimmy alone, where basically they construct group field theories incorporating these massive degrees of freedom. So I suppose that this would be the only way to get rid of this dependence on the triangulation. So of course, in this sense, this is a partial result. So concerning the perspectives, I mean, anyhow, I believe that this remains interesting to investigate because we get some interesting notions between the subtle interplay between fermions and geometry, so we can still go forward here. So one thing we could do, for instance, is compute the asymptotics of all these vertex amplitudes that I have written down to see if somehow we get something which is close to the continuum action. This would be one way to check if things are working correctly. Of course, we could try and generalize this work to four dimensions, which seems a non-trivial task, but this could be pursued. And of course, it would be very interesting to go further and to compute the fermionic propagator in this model. And I haven't been through the details yet, but I think that the tools developed here could give a relatively easy answer to this question. So this is all I have to say to conclude. And also, yes, this involves your question on the dependence on triangulation, Rabbi, definitely, yes.
Okay, so, but even if we have the group field theory, right, I mean, the group field theory, there's a certain coupling constant, and we don't understand, at least I don't understand the meaning of that coupling constant. So at the end of the day, is there any sense in which one actually has solved a quantum field theory, either with fermions or with scalar fields or something, in which there is an unambiguous answer that like string theories or particle physicists or quantum field theories would understand and agree that in fact that theory is finite? Do we have any finiteness result, say using group field theory or any other technique starting from spin foams?
This is a very, very deep point. The physics of the group field theory, I mean, to my knowledge anyway, is far from being clear. I mean, there are some results, but as you stress, what is this coupling constant? How do you implement different weights over different topologies? I mean, there are a lot of things that need to be clarified. So the group field theory is a step forward, but I mean, to my knowledge anyway, it's not a complete answer. I mean, I totally agree. Now, concerning the existence of other models, well, of course, you've got these point-particle couplings in three dimensions, which have got a very intricate intricate relation to quantum field theories via Feynman diagrams. So these models, being topological invariants, are completely exact. So they do give a satisfactory answer to this issue. But the relationship then to the field theory, to me anyway, is not very clear, because you start from point particle couplings. In a given limit, you can recover the Feynman diagrams of quantum field theory, which is very beautiful. But starting with a continuum action of fields, where you would implement the non-triviality of the theory, since it would have local degrees of freedom, you wouldn't obtain the same thing. So, these models are definitely satisfactory, because with point particles, you are topologically invariant, so you are writing exact models. Even in a discretized framework, you are already at the continuum limit. But the links to fields, to me, is not yet clear.
Thank you very much. Actually, I have many other questions, so the floor is open for questions, discussions, comments.
Mike, this is Carrie Lee.